Started. Jim, you said we're not expecting any other members that you know of?
Not that I've heard from.
Okay. All right, so it's 4 o'clock on January 11th. We're going to call to order the Shellfish Management Advisory Committee meeting, and I'll turn it over to Jim.
All right, just, I mean, I'm sure all of you know that just before we get going, this is, I'm retiring at the end of this month, so my replacement is sitting there, Andrew Button, right behind me. I mean, so he'll be the one working with y'all.
Name again?
Huh? Andrew Button. I mean, he's been in here in most of the meetings that we've had. He's just been sitting in the audience.
How do you spell his last name?
Button, just like a button on your coat.
Okay.
I can do that.
I think it would help, Jim, if it's all right. Maybe we start and do some introductions for Andrew. Let's start with Tommy.
Tommy Kellum, Kellum Oyster Company.
Ben Johnson, Johnson & Son.
John DeMaria, DeMaria Seafood.
A.J. Erskine, Bevin's Oyster Company and Coward Seafood.
J.C. Hudgens, Virginia Waterman Association.
Ernest George, a waterman.
Wayne France, waterman, Northern Neck.
Okay. Welcome, Andrew.
Andrew.
I mean, we normally get together at this time. We're kind of a month early, but I was trying to get stuff done before for us going to get the replenishment plan so that Andrew would have a head start on getting going on everything, because it's not as easy as it used to be with getting permits to do more stuff that we have to do now that we didn't used to have to do. But this is just to remind you of the harvest. The harvest did go a little bit down last year, 15-16, but the private ground harvest actually went up, so we didn't drop very much in total harvest for the state, so that's good. This year probably is going to go down a little bit from last year, but hopefully the private will pick up the slack, and you know we'll have a similar harvest that we've been having. The plan is relatively simple. We don't have any federal grants or anything. We're going to continue to do the moving James River seed this year to half at 10,000 bushels, half Sonoma, half Yocomico. Last year we did Yocomico and Cone. So this year we'll go back. We haven't done Nominop in 2 years. This is still we do not get a dollar return for a dollar investment. It costs us almost $10 a bushel to do them, and we don't re-catch 2,000 bushels of the 10,000 every year. So it is a losing proposition, but the money comes from the user fee, so it's waterman's money that's being reused. this is just in case you want to think about it. I mean, this is a long-term stock assessment for the James River seed areas, and you see we're nice and high, higher than we've been out there. So the James River's in good shape. We've had good spats for the past 2 years, so there's a lot of seed out there. We're going to continue the one bushel of seed for two bushels of shell program in the Great Wicomico and Piangtank. The Piangtank has more stock. When you look at the stock in the Piangtank, we're up on the seed bar. I mean, in the area, we got about more than 80,000 bushels total there, so we can handle taking 20,000 out there a year. In contrast, we don't have as many the Great Wicomico on our public beds. We only got about 20,000 bushels, and we'll take up to 10,000 out of those. But we have these other ones over here on the sanctuary areas of the court. So we don't have as many orchards in the Great Wicomico as we have in the Piangtank, but it's still enough that, we can let some go out of that area. And so if you want to do that, a waterman or a leaseholder signs up, responds to our notices, says how many bushels they like to do. They have to work out the arrangements of getting shell put back on the area, and for every bushel they take, they put two bushels of shell back, every bushel of seed they take. Based on our stock assessment, we have about 1,100 acres that need shell. They drop below the threshold that we use of, if it gets below 5 liters of shell per meter, then we reshell it. And you know, at the cost of Shell. I mean, we can't afford that much, so this is the areas that we're going to target. You know, hope that we can, you know, we're in the $4 a bushel, four something a bushel for Shell now, and so we have other areas we can go get if the price comes in lower, but this is what we figure we'll be able to afford out of the $2 million we have, where all that money, the $2 million, goes for Shell. The biggest issue we have out in front of us, and I mean, just to know where these areas are, like in the James, these are the two areas that need Shell. The York, these are the areas that need Shell. We're going to do Mob Jack this year. This is the areas that need Shell. We're going to do Deep Rock this year, because haven't gone in there in a while, and add some Shell back. And then the Rappahannock. And those are the areas that we're going to concentrate on. We've done Pocahontas Tangier 2 years in a row, and it's more expensive to go up there, and we've not got a good spat set up there in the past 2 years, so we're going to give that at least a year's rest and see if the spat set improves. But our Shell comes primarily from mining Shell in the James River. This is the biggest question mark that we have right now. This dredge has been working in the either in Maryland and Virginia, or Maryland and Virginia, since the 70s, is on the market to be sold now. The person that owns it wants to retire. So the big question we have is just whether we'll be able to find a buyer for it that will then pick up and do the work that we're doing. I mean, the only work this barge gets is the $2 million that Virginia has. We're hoping Maryland gets back into Shell dredging, but so far they don't have a permitted site. But should this dredge not be able to work, or one of the things that they've been talking about is actually all the big superstructure on this thing, all the top of this is where the shells go up and they're clean and they're sorted into big shells and fines. So we just plant the big shells. There's been some talk that if he can't sell it, if nobody wants to do the shell dredge anymore, he's just going to take that off and just use the front of it as a normal mud dredge. And this, nobody's ever going to build one of these things again. I mean, we'll just won't have that access to that kind of shell. The areas that we've been taking shell from, you know, we have these two areas. We have four areas up at Tri-Bell, up away. This is Hog Island. This is above Deepwater Light. These two areas, we've gotten all the shells out of them. We have these two little areas that still exist up there. But last year, we moved down the river to just basically straight off the building here. This big area has fossil shells that were located years ago when they were mining shell for doing road beds. And this is one that never got taken. So this is one that we got a permit for last year and that we worked out of last year. And the shells were really nice. The only difference is that up at Tri-Bell, those shells up there in those two that we've cleaned up the areas, we would actually find shell from the surface, maybe a foot on the surface, down to about 40 feet. That's as deep as we could go with the digger they have. They probably are below that. So the vein was that deep, so it was very concentrated, where the ones in the James have been in a band from about, that it has been like 8 to 10 feet thick. And so, you know, it's not nearly as deep as the ones that are up there, even though the shells have been very nice. They're about 6 or 8 feet under the surface before you hit the shell, but the vein itself is only 8 to 10 feet. But the difference is that where we only have 4 or 5 acres in the site up there at Tri-Bell, this entire area is over 600 acres that we can draw the shells from. So, you know, it's not an endless supply of shells, but there's certainly, at the rate we're going, you know, 20 years or so of shell there. If this, if the dredge does not, it doesn't work, and I'm still very confident that we're going to find a buyer between now and the spring for it, then really the only alternative would be the the few house shells, which we really don't want to get in and compete for them because we don't want to compete against the aquaculture industry. And we'd have to go to, you know, something like this is some experiments we've done. You can see these are rocks. They set very well. We've used this size of the size we used 2 years ago, and we get excellent sets on them. They look like this year. They're almost market size in just a year. This is in the Rappahannock. I mean, we've got excellent results on them. We also used a bigger size 3 years ago that people worked on this year, but the bigger size was supposed to be the size of a shell, so it would be 3-inch orchard. And they were so heavy that they crushed some of the orchards while they're harvesting them. And so when you cull off of them, you've done so much damage to the orchards that they're not as good. Where the ones that we use the next year, the pieces of stone are smaller than the orchard, so you either won't have to knock them off, or when you knock them off, it won't cause a problem. The problem with it is that there's only going to be certain bars in that we normally work on that you'll be able to use stone for at the low amounts that we do now. We do 1,000 bushels per acre of shell, which is one shell thick. But if you put these just one rock thick, they'll go in the bottom. So we're going to have to use more tons per acre of rock than we do shell, which would mean that we'll be able to do less acres. And you won't. And some of our best harvest areas are that muddy sand. It's firm, but it's not too hard. The shells stay up on it. These will not stay up on it. The only way you'll be able to do these areas if you put like the equivalent of say 5,000 bushels of rock on an acre in order to build the bottom and firm it, so that just the top layer would then be available for harvest. So our world will be very different in the Bay if we have to go to rocks or ground concrete. Turns out rocks are just easier because you don't have trash in it like we have ground concrete. Easier to get, ready supply. So it looks like if we would go that way, you would be using just crushed granite. The other two things the program will do will be we have a project with the Nature Conservancy on Seaside where they've gotten some money that'll keep our one contractor on Seaside busy for the summer. They've got enough money to build like 6 acres over there with him. And then we're going to continue to move a little bit of the we planted some areas that the Waterman had recommended at two sites in Pocomoke Sound 3 or 4 years ago, and part of it stayed up and part of it didn't. It wasn't a great site. And so what we did this past year is we went and got the shell up that is sunk on the bad parts and put it on the good part. And there's still some of those shell left, and this year we want to take some of those shell and move it to the one sanctuary we have in Tangier Sound, which is Cod Harbor, which is an old Hantong area that they try to do something to start boosting the populations over there to try to get the spat set back up. It'd just be a little project to hire the local waterman over there, Jerry Pruitt, to harvest those shells and move them to a different location, the ones that have sunk. So it's a pretty simple plan this year, and that's basically what it is. So any questions?
Anybody have questions? I imagine there might be one or two questions.
Yeah, one question I got, if I may. Is 2 bushels of shells for every bushel of seed that you get. Why 2 bushels? Why is it 2?
Well, so that basically watermen can afford it. I mean, in reality, we probably should be getting about 3, but we make 2 bushels of shells, so it's a reasonable cost for somebody to come catch a seed.
So, I mean, the 2 bushels of shells, that's your theory, that would be equivalent to that?
Well, we put it right back on the same area, so to keep that bar in good shape.
So 2 would be sufficient, is what you're saying?
Well, it's probably not sufficient, but we're holding our own. It'd be nice to improve it, but we're not improving it with that. But we're holding
you're maintaining.
Tommy?
Jim, on the Mobjack, the number of, if I read that right, that's 106,000 bushels.
Mm-hmm.
The think we would be better to put that in some areas we're seeing a better return based on what we've done there?
Well, I mean, actually, you know, Mobjack has looked real good, you know, the past. It's Mobjack jumps up and down, and it may be rerun. I mean, I think I'm going to put a few more in deep rock of those that we were going to get there. But we're trying to get, we have worked one time of doing shell plants out at Browns Bay, but we didn't put enough shell. So we wanted to try to get out there and shell that along while we were in there. So that's a pretty big area. But if that's going to be the third rotation area for the two York areas and that one, we need more than just the little sites we have. So this was to get one more bigger site in there. So, you know, if you're going to go in Mobjack and get the other two, you might as well catch those too on the way in, because we save money on the stuff by having less big locations with more stuff within the location. So we're overestimating Mobjack, and we'll probably pick up that with, I mean, we have 1,000 acres if we need it, but we'll move it around probably into the deep rock area for some of it, and maybe somewhere else in the Rappahannock. But deep, it's not going to take all that. That's just a
deep rock's what I was thinking. That's,
yeah,
what
I mean. Once we have 3 areas, we have 6 areas in deep rock that we take care of. 3 of them are down below the shell threshold, and we started thinking about it, and we haven't changed our maps yet, that if you're going to go in there, you might go and do all 6 of them, because you're not going to come back to that area for a while. So that will pick up another, like, 40 acres at deep rock to do that. So it'll take those away from Mobjack. But, I mean, you know, we got a good set in Mobjack last year. I mean, just to show what Mobjack is doing, this is what we're seeing in Mobjack right now. These make it, not next year because we'll be in New York, but the year after that. I mean, we're up to, you know, it's like 25,000 bushels in there now, where this is where we were no time ago. So, you know, it would be a decent place for people to go if we got these other areas.
Is it a priority of law enforcement to keep an eye on that area? It just seems we always get decent stocks there, and it never comes to fruition.
I know, and that's a big worry. We had a big part of our spat set last year that has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully they will. I mean, we've been worried about it. And, you know, they could do that at Deep Rock too, because I'm sure nobody looks. Mobjack's closer to run to.
It just seems that's where we go, you know, season after season, and don't see the returns.
You know, I mean,
and obviously the oysters.
Like 6 or 7 years ago, we had a decent harvest out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no reason that if we keep it shelled, that you wouldn't get a harvest out there.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Have you checked East River this year, Jim?
East River?
Yeah. Yeah, right there at the mouth of East River.
Yeah, that's what's doing this right now.
This right, okay.
Doing this big.
The one that you closed last year was supposed to open, didn't open.
Yeah. That's what bumped the stocks up, yeah.
Because we were, 3 years on that now, I think.
Well, and we know that at least half of those got poached this past summer.
Oh, I did?
Yeah. But even with that, we have
a lot. Yeah, because it's a small place, yeah.
Small place, yeah.
Jim, you have a range for shells in here, $2.50 to $4 a bushel. Can you explain the range?
Oh, whether house shells close in some areas versus house shells long way and dread shells a long way. It depends on distances. You know, we get them for around $3 in the James because we're dredging right there, the stuff that you dread. Where taking Tangier, they're more than $4. So it just depends. It's all travel distance, because they have to mobilize all their stuff up to any area we go to.
So the price for house shells will be, in 2017, will be the same as it was 2016?
Yeah. Okay. And you know, we're hoping, I mean, if all the cards play out like we would like to see, this shell dredge has been bounced around amongst 3 or 4 different big It's a little dredge. It's not really owned by anybody but this one person. And it's been, in order to cover the insurance stuff, there's been some of these big companies that have put in the bid. And they put this tremendous profit margin on everything because of the risk involved and something they don't understand. So we're hoping if we can get a local contractor buy it, that we'll be get back down into the twos and threes where it used to be. Because it was just because they had that, they added this tremendous profit on it for doing something they had never done before. And it's common knowledge. They're only asking $500,000 for this dredge. And the guy's willing to finance it over 5 years. So, you know, it's a very reasonable investment for somebody if we can. And I got a couple of young guys that are thinking about it. It's just a very strange piece of equipment to get involved.
Yeah, we pay them, what, $1.5 million? 1.3?
Two.
1.2.
Yeah. But it's
$2 million.
But all these big people are all union. And if we got to a smaller person, we could get a union wage. Mm-hmm.
So. Other questions? Jim, you mentioned some of the bottom was not necessarily going to support the alternative substrate, or at least the smaller piece. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility of, well, let's assume
it will, but you're just going to have to build it up more than you build it up for show. It'll support it. It just means you're going to have to build it up.
Yeah, but you can't do one rock thick, is what you were saying.
Can't do one rock thick.
So let's say the dredge thing is in question. You're looking at an alternative substrate. Is there a possibility of building up that ground with larger stone or rock, and then putting the smaller stone on top?
Everybody's dredges would get hung in that and be just done for. Mm-hmm. I mean, it there's no way of skimming off the top of that with it. These little rocks work really good. It's going to be really interesting to see this spot next year in the Rappahannock with all these orchards on it. But they work really good. It's just that whatever the density is of the rock is different than the shell on the. And the way it lays flat versus being round, it just goes in the bottom quicker than a shell does.
What size are those little rocks?
We use rocks that are about this size, about an inch and a half.
I don't know exactly.
And you blow them off with a water cannon just like you blow off.
What do they cost?
Same thing as shell. Because the closest one is coming from, we were doing about $40 a ton, which would be around 3 bushel.
So where are they coming from?
Oswell. Fall line. They got to come from fall. I mean, if you get them from a local contractor down here, they've already got the travel in it. So it's better off. I mean, it's good work for some of the local truckers in the northern Mac and stuff to be able to go up and get those rocks and bring them to stockpiles and everything. So, I mean, it's not that it's not a bad thing for the economy. It's just that it's going to limit the amount.
What's the weight difference between that and shells?
Almost double.
Yeah. I think it's like
1.8 or
something. It takes 1.6 tons to make a cubic yard. And we do stuff in tons for the rocks. So it...
figuring the freight when we hauled it, we were figuring basically it took double the weight to haul the rock that it did the shell. So if we put 1,000, the equivalent of 1,700 to 1,000 bushels on a dump trailer, you were putting 300 to 500 of rock.
So the weight per cubic foot of occupant, the weight per volume.
Which you get so more. I mean, you don't get the fluff you get with shells. When you put the shells in a basket or a dump trailer, you're getting air pockets with gravel.
Yeah.
A bushel of shells would weigh maybe, 60, 70 pounds? And
75.
A bushel of rocks.
Yeah.
But you can imagine if you filled a orange basket up with bluestone and picked it up versus a...
I've seen different pieces of ground, you have that you got a lot of little stones on it, but it's just, I guess it's just the bottom so hard it supports that. It's not any problem, but I know it works. But I just...
No, it works fine.
Yeah, but I've never seen... I'm not... That size, an inch and a half like golf balls, it's...
I remember going to a symposium one time, and they were working with the coal industry, and they had some method. They were covering that stuff up with cement. You worked probably the same thing.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, we used coal ash at one time for a big project that we built a reef out of, but people's minds about coal has changed a whole lot since we did that.
They don't want to.
We did that in the mid-90s. Now I think they would be very upset with you.
Yeah. I would think the coal industry would want to subsidize something like that just to get rid of it.
We had talked to them about that, because we mixed the coal with, we had a special hopper built and everything to make the stuff that mixed the concrete with the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Orchard's likely fine. It's just that now they're finding all these trace elements and stuff that are not so good in the water.
Yeah,
mercury and arsenic and all kinds of stuff. I don't think we'd want to go for that. All right, you want to move on to that?
Any more questions? Okay. Move on to the next one.
All right. at one of the commission meetings, I guess, maybe in, was it September or October?
Somewhere in the summer, I think.
One of the commissioners, Commissioner Ballard, asked for this committee to evaluate the conflicts between SAV and aquaculture. SAV means submerged aquatic vegetation. And there's really not many people on this committee that's very interested in that, so I just picked a couple of people on this to serve on a subcommittee for this committee. We have Tommy Leggett and Richie Harden wanted to be on it, and AJ's on it, and then we have more people in aquaculture to join in. The issue had been that when we, in our leasing program, we don't lease on SAV. But there are some places where SAV comes into an area that is already a standing lease. And as long as you keep your cages or your clams or anything where you have that and use the same footprint, you're all right. But if you go into these areas, these new areas where SAVs come in, then it's a violation the way things are right now if there's any SAV. And VIMS checks all of our lease applications and tells leasing whether the lease is okay or not for a new lease. So that one's really not very much of a problem. The problem has been on a few places as cage aquaculture has grown and expanded, there's some places now that we're starting to see some conflicts where SAV has expanded, or maybe SAV was there, and in some years it's real sparse, and some years it gets thicker, and still not very thick. And you move your cages there, and then when they check you with aerial photos, or we see on aerial photos, when Ben sees it, you see that your cages are in an SAV bed. And Eric classifies as SAV. So this committee was formed to see if we can figure out some way to work through that so more acres would possibly be available. And we've had two meetings, and they've been mostly informational. The first one was kind of all information. Second one was, we actually came in with a straw man document on possible ways we could do things, and the committee didn't like it very much. And so what we've done, we've gone back now, and we're kind of going to start back over from scratch again by having VIMS redo the way they classify SAV. Now they have one classification that's sparse of it's 0 to 10%. And we know that there's no such thing as zero, and that confuses people because it wouldn't be in that group if it was a zero. It would be no SAV. So they're going to redo their maps and come up with just four classifications, basically between a sparse, which will be less than 10, and then break down the higher categories. And I think what we'll be looking at is if we can come up with some way to have some way that cages could actually be in a in that 10% or less zone. And we're not sure whether it'll fly because, right now the relationship we have with the Corps is that
we have this allowance on 12 inches that they let us not have permits because they know we're keeping people out of SAVs. So what we don't want to do is to bring out the Corps in watching over everything that we do like they watch over in some other states. So, and we also have the Bay Program goals of getting SAV back that we don't want to be looking like we're in conflict with that. So it's the committee, I think, thought that we'd wrap it up really quick, and it's turned out it's not going to be a quick thing. What they're going to do first is they're redoing their maps, and they've already put our lease maps on their maps at VIMS. What they're going to do now is transfer these, their SAV coverage over to our maps here that people will be able to go online and look at. And we're going to have a 1-year SAV, a 3-year, and a 5-year to evaluate on how many different areas change. And this is really, majority of the conflicts are on the Bay side of the Eastern Shore. Little bit of conflict in like Back River, York River, Pocosin River. But generally, it's not been too terrible of an issue, so hopefully we can come out of some way to give a little bit for the cages and at the same time protect our relationship with DEQ and the Corps on keeping aquaculture healthy. So,
any questions for Jim? So I know it was a little bit of a topic that I asked about for an update, and I know they're not done with the committee, but I had one question about, did the committee talk at all, and maybe this is in regulation already, about transient versus resident species?
Yeah. And they're, as far as wishing grass, and that's, it's apparently from them, it's almost impossible for them to tell in their aerial. They can tell if they go ground truth it. But I don't think they really want to give, and we get the same credit for SAV acres for widgeon grass as you do eelgrass. So, some conflict with the Bay Program goals and EPA, the DEQ goals on that too. So, but that discussion has been had with them in that 10%.
Yeah, it seems like a different discussion when you're talking about a transient SAV that would be there, for a short period of time and in a worst-case scenario, exclude shellfish aquaculture that is also benefiting the SAV versus a real resident species that's there.
Right. We've talked that, and we've not gotten deep into that because we kind of just stopped so we can see these maps first. Mm-hmm. Once you have some maps in front of you, then you can start, in your mind, you can start saying, well, I know this area is widgeon grass, so should that area have the same priority? But until we get those things on the map, people won't be able to identify with their location and have some comments. So.
Right.
It's hard to nebulous talk about these layers,
Yeah.
Is there a case where it's been pushed that someone had to relocate?
There's a couple people in violation right now.
And what's the protocol for that? They have to relocate everything out of that?
I think everything's pretty much on hold until we get through this, isn't it? I mean, we've kind of decided to
nothing yet
to not push anybody off until we had this committee, look into it. So. And they're aware of the SAVBS.
Well, I don't know if this committee knows or not, but, the commission's been pretty liberal with setting aside SAV acreage, primarily the Eastern Shore,
right.
I believe.
On seaside.
On seaside, about areas, for SAV restoration. Even in such that areas that have not had or do not have SAV, just projected to where SAV will colonize. And that area's been set aside. So,
yeah, the big thing is that you don't get any credit for that for the Bay Program.
Yeah. Well, I understand that. But as far as the conflict between, a potential conflict between SAV and aquaculture, and like you say, knowing what other states are currently going through with conflicts in SAV and aquaculture, I think it's something that Virginia needs to be very aware of.
Right. So it is moving. It's just not had a lot of progress.
Right.
And it's not, I mean, I don't think it's a trivial thing for VIMS to redo these later, so it's going to take them a little bit of time.
Right, okay. Thank you, Jim. So we had one other thing on the agenda, which was legislative issues that may impact the shellfish industry. And Jim asked that myself, with the help of others, would discuss some of these, maybe, so the committee, ESMAC, can know what is proposed as of now in the General Assembly. So I appreciate you putting it on the agenda. Do you want us to get into that now, or
yeah.
Do you want to go into something else?
No, this is it. I mean, once we finish up, that's the last thing.
Okay. So just for the committee's information, there's probably, probably 8 or 10, six or eight oyster bills, specific shellfish bills that are up in Richmond. And they'll be discussed in the next 6 weeks, I guess. And they have to do with, one has to do with the culling law, and that is, and I might need some help probably in discussing what the actual intent of the bill is and things. But this bill in particular is, to my knowledge, when someone is caught with a culling violation, that load of oysters by law is supposed to go back on the public rock. And that language is proposed to be stricken from the code. So you would not actually have to put the oysters overboard, but it does not say where the oysters would go, where the cargo of oysters would go. So there's a problem with the bill because it doesn't actually describe whether it would go on a sanctuary, whether it would go on the public rock, or whether the small oysters that are mixed in the cargo of the load of oysters would actually be landed, which is clearly a violation. So there's some help that needs to go on with that bill. There's another one that has to do with the process for license revocation, and that is proposed to take the maximum amount of revocation from 5 years to 2 years, and also no longer allow the commission to impose a revocation of all tidal fishing privileges. So you may recall that there are repeat offenders that come before the commission, and they may be imposed with a revocation that would either be specifically for that fishery, or it would be all tidal fishing privileges, which means they cannot go into crab fishery or gill net fishery, or, you know, so on and so on. Wayne?
Will the monetary amount still be up to $10,000?
The bill did not describe any change in the civil penalty. So it was only specific to, as far as I understand, two aspects of the code, and that was reducing the maximum penalty of revocation from 5 years to 2 years, and then also eliminating the ability for the commission to revoke all tidal fishing privileges. So the commission would have the ability for revoking an oyster license if those violations were in the oyster fishery.
Only.
Correct. Then there's another bill that has to do with, there are actually two bills, a Senate and a House bill, but they mirror one another, and they're about oyster ground applications and notification of those oyster ground applications. And you're probably familiar, everybody's probably familiar with the process that takes place now to file an application for oyster ground. this would change it slightly. For example, it would be posted on the BMRC website. It would reduce the number of weeks in the newspaper from 4 weeks to 2 weeks, and it would notify adjacent oyster leaseholders, and it would also notify riparian landowners within 200 feet of the proposed application. So if it's less than 200 feet, they would not be notified. And the last provision that's in there that I think will be removed through some work in the industry is notifying the localities, the county, of the pending application. So I think that's going to be removed because it's not really the purview of the locality. It's VMRC. It's the state. So I don't know how many I'm up to. Three, I guess.
Sanctuary dredge in the
sanctuary. Yeah, you want to take that one, Tommy?
I don't know. I understand. There's a bill that would address traveling through a sanctuary, a closed area with a dredge. In my understanding, and Kim Husky's got knowledge, has read it, my understanding is basically there would be no law against being anywhere with a dredge on board. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you're going through the middle of, I'll use Drummond Ground because I know it, and you got a dredge on board, so be it.
Well, 2 o'clock in the morning now,
there's
already here.
No, not for travel.
Not for, yeah, that's only if you're harvesting. It's a law against harvesting, but this would change the code that has you going anywhere with the way I read it now, unless you're going to, for repairs to a shipyard or...
You're not supposed to be out after sunset or before an hour before sunrise with a dredge on the boat to go anywhere. Minus repair doesn't figure into that. Dock to dock for relocating doesn't figure into that. If you're out past sunset, between sunset and an hour before sunrise with a dredge on the boat, you're in violation regardless of what you're doing and where you are.
That's what I've always heard.
Well, where would this, what does this change then?
Well, 2 o'clock is different. It's a lot of different.
It would be in legal hours.
It changes the fact that if you left Deep Creek, you could run to Point of Shoals and go across Wreck Shoals doing it. Or you could leave Carter's Creek and run across Drummond Ground when it's closed as in its 3-year rotation, which makes it a 2-year sanctuary, and go somewhere in Rappahannock to work instead of having to run down the river and around or whatever is what it would.
The issue now is, and my understanding is there's some regulation, I guess, coming before the commission that would give some travel ways, but as it's...
I mean, I can show you that if you want to see. It's no change in regulation, just changing our map.
Right.
Yeah, why don't you pull that up, Jim?
Yeah. Wait soon.
Half hour for hands
scraping. We've just opened this up so that there's the sanctuaries are pulled back. So there's a way to travel through there. This is the only place that we know there's this issue going on.
It was violation at Sturgeon in December.
For crossing here?
Right, crossing Sturgeon.
They shouldn't be over there.
Yeah. Up until this year, they hadn't been enforcing it.
Yeah.
Then this year, all of a sudden, they decided to enforce it.
Yeah.
And they let 4 or 5 boats go and give one boat a ticket.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, as soon as the public season closes, I can't leave my dock and get in Nansman River without crossing a piece of closed bottom.
Mm-hmm. Because how long is not a sanctuary?
Everybody goes to their private grounds all year long across carrying addresses.
That's my point.
Huh?
That is my point.
I mean, so it's allowed.
What's the difference between closed bottom and sanctuary, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean,
closed management area.
Right.
Closed management area, yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got the same issue in Rappahannock. You can't leave Carter's Creek and get to a piece of my ground without going through a closed area.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. It's not a sanctuary, though.
In other words, when I leave Mosquito,
yeah,
I got to pretty much run for the middle of the bridge.
Yep.
Yeah.
Where that old law.
So, yeah, we've opened it up now so that you can go right through there, though.
So how would it work then in this?
Well, I broke
in this
the law
instance.
Every day for the year. I broke the law every day for the
Nobody
year.
Nobody has ever given a ticket for that. These one happened to happen on a Saturday, which got everybody.
Yeah.
So what happens if you have a dredge on board? You go through a piece of ground that's closed, and to get to a private piece of ground, let's say, and you get a load of oysters on.
As long as you got a permit for that one you're going to, you're allowed to do it now.
But then you can
go back. You're not, like, if you're in the James, you remember we changed the law that you can't cross that one little wreck shoal sanctuary.
Right.
You got to go around that.
Right.
This will let them go across that with a dredge all summer.
And a load of oysters.
And a load of, in the summer, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
AJ,
let me come back to that first one, because we talked to law enforcement about this as well, the culling.
Mm-hmm.
And what's involved there is the way things are now, you can post a cash bond,
right?
Or you can dump everything anyway. And the way
on public rock.
The way that is now is you have to post a cash bond.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other choice. So what happens to those oysters is they stay with you, and then the court decides what happens with the charge, and, you know, if you're found not guilty, then the bond is back to you. If you're guilty, the bond's going to the state. But the unusual part is that you can be monitored again by law enforcement. So law enforcement brought this up. They'll go and they'll see that you have a culling violation. You'll take care of that. You'll keep the oysters. You'll post the cash bond. We don't know how everyone's going to be traveling around with cash like that. That's a problem in itself.
Right.
And then you could be visited again. I mean, it has happened in the past. So the really odd thing about that bill is that it takes away the option. You know, you have to post that cash bond. The odd thing about the last one you're talking about the harvest areas and having a dredge, is that I think it reads something like if you're going to a harvest area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, anyone's going to be going to a harvest area. I mean, it's, you know, there's some work to be done there, to say the least. But we typically, you know, John Bull typically works on the LASs. Mm-hmm. Others help him. Dan has helped. Everyone's helped. And so, I mean, there's definitely some work that needs to be done.
You know, one thing that I thought was real interesting when I was real heavily with scallops, the government, if when the count was not followed properly, the government would confiscate the trip, which is essentially what what you guys would be doing. But what would happen is they would put those scallops out where people could bid on them. And the reason I know, I bought high as 40,000 pounds of scallops at a time at a lesser price.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sold. So, I mean, if VMRC could do the same thing, could take those and put them on a bid, and that would give you something for your coffers for replenishment as well. So, I mean, that's a thought. I mean, the feds do it with scallops. Why?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Would it be a holding issue?
Yeah, that's right. I'm familiar with that as well.
Well, I mean, the cash bond is the value of the cargo. So,
mm-hmm.
basically, if you have 16 bushels and you're getting $40, you got to have that much money in your pocket to bond out.
Well, don't you keep them? Do you have to recull them? I always heard you had to recull them after you paid the cash bond.
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, I don't see how you can take small oysters.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I always heard.
And the unfortunate thing is that that takes time from law enforcement that they should be out doing other things.
Tommy,
my question and concern as a buyer is if
16 tickets.
If this bill were to pass, it still doesn't address being in possession of uncalled oysters on a truck, by boat, or in a facility. So even though they can keep the oysters, there's nothing to address that if those oysters are dumped on the back of a truck and that truck is stopped and called, which does happen, happened in York River last week, you know, then it becomes the burden of the purchaser.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the state or the buyer or whoever. So that's so it's contradictory to several other code sections, and that's sort of
so using the truck to launder the oysters.
Or be the scapegoat, depending on which way you want.
Well, I mean, that's what do you have much trouble with people buying them back? No, I'd heard some talk that their truck, they were trying to figure out how small oysters were getting on the truck, couldn't figure out who they were coming from.
Most everybody I've seen throw them overboard.
Yeah, now everyone would have to do it. If you had a culling violation, now you have to post a cash bond. So that becomes a whole new arena.
Oh, in other words, now if you get a culling violation, you got to post a cash bond.
Most of them return to the water.
You can either return them or give a cash bond.
Oh, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, really
see, this bill would propose to take
away.
There are
few people that have done
putting it over.
Cash bond.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but not doesn't replace anything, so it doesn't give you another option.
So is there like a time frame for that?
Immediately.
Well, I mean, I understand it. Immediately, you contribute the cash, but for the oysters to be gone through where they could be checked again, to verify that they're okay.
I thought they had to be real cold right on the boat.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is there a time? I mean, you can't. The oyster's got to be done. Something's got to be done. Something with
them at
some point.
Yeah. You got to recall them. What I understood.
Yeah.
They don't do it. You do it.
So, and they have to come back and check it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, they come back and check it. Okay.
So I guess the gist would be, based on all the comments and the questions here, it's not a real good bill.
That's just the wording.
You know. Chances are.
It's really worked pretty well, what we've had. I think there's some mistakes that get made on where they tell people to dump them that should be corrected.
Now, isn't it correct that they're supposed to be dumped at from the spot of harvest? Whether you take out at Deep Creek, if you took them up Nansman Ridge, you're supposed to go back to Nansman Ridge to plant them?
Yeah.
That's what it should used to be.
I think the code reads public rock.
Yeah.
Well, there's been so much concern in the meetings that we've gone to about making sure that the oysters are available for people who want to make a living and need to do this and to keep the part-timers out and stuff like that. I don't understand why you have an habitual offender that just will not conduct himself appropriately, and he gets a five-year sanction where he can't oyster anymore, and they want to reduce that to two. I don't understand.
We don't either. But.
Well, I mean, what is the basis of it? Did these guys... They don't understand the position that you have taken, that we need to make this industry available for the people that are full-time watermen. That
you need to talk to the bill writer.
Apparently, the
encourage you to do so.
The patron of the bill claims that it's too harsh.
Well, I saw it was in a paper from the
governor
of Pocosin.
Yes.
So I mean,
delegate health.
Yeah.
Yeah, he feels 5 years is too long to take a livelihood away from someone. So a two-year revocation, my understanding is two-year revocation was seen as more appropriate than 5 years. Tommy.
This Miss Jane left?
Yeah.
I was curious about any budget issues that would affect or any proposals that... that would affect the shellfish industry through personnel or that sort of thing.
Rob, do you know of any, or Jim, or Ben?
Not economically. I know a couple of the bills in the write-ups on the LAS, they talk about it affecting the harvester, because for those harvesters that are not causing problems, they're going to bear some of the brunt of having problems still in the fishery or the industry. And I think on the 2 and 5 year, I think the real issue there is not just that, and it's come up at the commission as well. If you have a violation in the oyster industry and you get revoked for everything, should it be that way, or should you just get revoked for the oyster fishery? If you have crab licenses, should you be able to go on crabbing and just not be able to oyster for 5 years? So that's really the companion part of that. But most, I haven't seen any economic figures, but
he was asking about just the budget in general.
Like personnel in your department or Ben's department or...
I see. Well, I think probably there's going to be no mercy for that. I mean, we just keep on having to do whatever is attached from any actions the General Assembly takes. I mean, that's always been the routine.
And in my purpose is it something an industry could help or lobby or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of my major concerns is like I've got a video right over here, and BMRC was involved in this, and a guy was sitting over shooting a video through the marsh grass over there in Fox Hill where people were getting polluted oysters out of that creek and then ran from BMRC. And I know you know about all this. But these guys over there are doing stuff like this and going to jeopardize somebody getting sick with a Virginia oyster, doing polluted oysters just randomly, and they have no concept of what we're talking about. You know, reducing their taking this stuff from 5 years to 2 years for them, they shouldn't even be allowed to be out there, as far as I'm concerned. That's just bad news.
So the other part.
I mean, this has got to be presented to these people, and I know you guys know all about this.
But you can make contact about the weekend.
The other part of that is.
I've been in front of the prosecutors over there, and they don't believe anything that you have to say.
Well, the legislator might.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
I mean, you need to contact the legislator saying that you don't like the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Or your legislator.
Well, I mean, you know, it was 2 years.
Talking about a damn one.
The General Assembly brought up to 5 years, 2 years ago.
For repeat offenders. Yeah. It's not for first time.
And then if you're caught revoked, and you get another summons while you're revoked, that's where the up to $10,000 fine comes in. Okay. Two cases of tradition already. So I guess there's been 75, I'd say roughly, revocations, probably in the high 40s or oyster related, or a little bit more. So, you know, that's only since 2013, since the middle of 2013.
But I believe only four or five have been 5-year revocations.
Right.
So it's used infrequently.
Well, because there's not many people go and do
right.
What they're supposed to do.
And I would also, about the tidal fishing privileges, I think it's important to note that yes, it's a maximum penalty, and it's very harsh, but when you look at the commission is given a briefing, and it has all the past history of that individual, and that individual may have crab violation, oyster violation, gill net violation, rockfish violation, whatever it might be. So you can examine all that, and it's clear violation throughout all of the licenses that an individual holds. So in that case, with a repeat offender, all tidal fishing privilege revocation may be appropriate. So it's taken a tool away from the commission that it could use for some of those people that don't belong out there, period, that jeopardize the entirety of the industry. So,
well, the hope is the plateau has been reached with these cases that have come forward. And, you know, that as we go forward, we're going to see less and less. I mean, that's all you can hope for, because it's a hard job for the commission to go through all these cases.
Ben, you had something?
Well, to address your budget question, in the governor's most recent version of the budget, there is a line item in my department to reduce the position through retirement. And that person is retiring 1st of February, so we will not be filling that position for the foreseeable future. So I'll be down to 3 surveyors.
So that's a field surveyor, and is the idea, and you may or may not be able to answer this, I don't know, but is the idea to move away completely from in-house surveying and privatize this?
Question I have, and I don't have the answer, but yes, that's a possibility. We'll have another retirement in June, probably 3rd retirement in October. Both my surveys.
And is it fair to say?
So the answer is yes.
Yeah. Is it fair to say, based on the private surveyors that you worked with, that at this point it's pretty tough to get one through without the aid of some of your staff and surveyors?
I would say that was correct, and it's pretty hard to get a private surveyor to do them, period. We work well with the few surveyors that we work with, but you know, you have to have somebody oversee this. We are the management agency for the leasing program.
And so, ballpark for 3 positions, dollar amount, what are we?
With benefits, something like $7,000 per position.
So the point I would bring to the commission is, any of us that apply for a piece of ground and need to get it surveyed, this little bit of money can be a real hassle down the road. Or if you want to restake, or you have an issue with your neighbor, you know, what he's talking about could be a real hassle for all of us down the road. It's a relatively small amount of money in the scheme of things in Richmond. My feeling for our business, or talking to any of these legislators, we need to push to have that money reinstated and give VMRC the ability to hire its own surveyors.
Yeah, it just seems logical that they would understand that, you know, with all the acreage that's involved in the state, you know, and is big of important, that private leases are to the industry and then the amount of volume that you show has come from, they would certainly understand the significance of having a surveyor or whatever amount of surveyors it need to be.
And it could be as simple.
Keyword was understanding. They don't understand.
Well, I mean, it's. I mean, he's got all this information right over here that they could put out. I mean, I think it would be very logical.
Again, talk to your legislator.
You know, the important thing for them to realize that we're not surveying land, and that you know, their rationale could be, well, their land survey is everywhere, and that's easy to do. Yes. We'll just the state can get rid of this expense and not realize the complexities of Ben's department and dealing with you and I in an argument, because I say my line's here and you say it's there. It's
so the other two positions that you said are going to have retirements, those will not be filled either.
I don't know.
Okay.
I understand very clearly that you don't know, but don't they ask for any input from you?
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean,
that's our job. Mm-hmm.
I mean, trust me, I've been lobbying here myself to keep my apartment intact because I can't keep up with the four surveyors I currently have. I mean, I can't keep up with the number of applications. We cannot. I mean, it's not possible to survey 300 applications a year, which is what we got in the last 2 years, with four people. It's just not humanly possible. And now I'm going to have three people. And I don't know past that what's going to happen. It could be that we rehire in June that person in October, and we'll still have three people. But without funding from the General Assembly, it's apparent to me from my boss that we're not filling this current.
So the priorities of how the budget is being used is established by who?
Really.
Well, I mean, so nobody in VMRC can identify the priorities that what needs to be.
A little bit, and when Tommy asked that question, I was truly thinking of the legislation, not of the agency. So, when there's a budget cut, everyone gets together in the agency and looks at everything that possibly could be part of the budget cut. That's already been done. If Jane McCroskey was here, she would give you a point-on summary of everything. By the way, Jane's retiring March 1 after 41 years. So that's going to be something else along with his truly Dr. Wesson leaving us. So we have things that are already there. Most of them from the direct fisheries end are on the recreational side or on projects. So, for example, you know, and that was available December 19th, I think, is when that information came out, the governor's budget. So that's where it is now. Now it's up to the General Assembly to see what they go along with. We have a saltwater tournament, which you're probably familiar with, that gives out plaques and citations for fish that weigh more than a certain amount or release a certain amount. That's one that's up for being removed. We have some projects where we sample elvers. Through VIM's work, we're cutting back on that, reducing that. So literally, you have to, when you get to the second budget cut, which is what this was, you have to sort of nitpick anywhere you can where you think, okay, this is not good, but other things are worse. So as a composite, if you look online and look at what's in the governor's budget, you'll see everything that we have. But again, most of it is not related to shellfish from our end, from Ben's end. Yes, there's some direct impacts. And so, I mean, that's how it really works. And, you know, the agency head, along with the chiefs, has the final decision on what really to send up to Department of Planning and Budget. And then Department of Planning and Budget can say, we don't like that, do something else. So it's quite a process. And unfortunately, I think the statistic is that VMRC has had budget cuts in 21 of the last 24 years or something like that. I mean, John Bull knows that off his top of his head because he's been involved in about a dozen of them. So you know, that's where things stand. Now it's up to the General Assembly to say, we think that this should not be taken away from BMRC, or this should. And so, you know, that's the way the process works, and that's why Jim is saying talk to your legislators, because there are some direct impacts from what the surveyors, the loss of the surveyors, would be to, you know, the agency and to you. I mean, so that's very tangible.
And we
wait to see the outcome of some of these other situations.
Well, I understand all that, but I still don't understand where what's got priority over top of what we need to have for the oyster industry. I don't understand that. I mean, you got fish that you take care of, and other things that you take care of. But why is?
Well, we're pretty much down to bare bones.
Yeah. Well, but I know I understand that. But
what I'm trying to tell you is that management here had to come up with
the best of the worst.
And traditionally, I think Rob would be able to back me up. Every commissioner has been here from Pruitt since I've been here forward has prided themselves on never having to fire somebody.
Right.
Fake a budget.
That's right.
This position was known, was coming open because of a retirement, so we're not firing anybody. So that had got in the mix. And fishing turf. There's a bunch of other items that are also getting reduced funding or cuts.
So am I understanding that the budget that's allocated to your department has already been definitively established years ago, and it always stays the same? So it changed, but
years ago,
each department's budget, it's a negotiation. It takes one department gets more money or less money, or they all get cut, or some maybe not get as cut as much because they're deemed to be more critical. There's nothing.
No, not really. So, I mean, the history of the agency is we're strictly general funds up until a certain point. And then more and more we were funded through special funds. So that now it's about half and half of both. But for your question, it's really no more complicated than everyone gets together and figures out what is the best of the worst things that we can offer up the budget funds. And as you just heard Ben say, someone was retiring, so, you know, that seemed like one avenue. For the saltwater tournament, it seemed as if, yes, that's good tourism, but compared to everything else we have, perhaps, you know, that's one of the best of the worst. That's all it is. It's not a situation where anything changes in the overall relative scope of the budget. So fisheries has always had a line item of budget. Habitat has had a line item of budget. Law enforcement has. But over the years, there's been growth from other sources, special funds, and there's been takeaways. That's the important thing. There's been so many takeaways that we could go on and on about this. I know you don't want that, but it's pretty rugged. I mean,
Wayne had a question.
We have law enforcement positions that we haven't been able to hire for years.
Yeah, my question is, I'm sure one of you three gentlemen can answer it, but I think you guys do a great job, first of all, with what you have to work with. It's just four people. It's outstanding. But if this was to go to private industry, how much is an application in the process going to cost from private industry doing it or BMRC doing it?
Well, we have one firm that's doing quite a few in Middle Peninsula, and they have become fairly competitive with what we charge, but my opinion as a registered land surveyor is that you will not get porch ground application surveys done for $675, which is what we currently charge. It's not a profit sector. Because we are a nonprofit. We don't make a profit. I figure what the cost is, the equipment, the time, and that's how we come up with our costs. And I try to make it realistic what it really costs us. For profit companies, for profit. The land surveyor, right, don't want to make a
direct
profit. So it's going to cost you. Maybe you can get them done quicker because you go out on free market. I have some questions about that too, but we'll see.
That's a good question. I think that's a good question.
And, you know, if we truly privatize, then at least not, now they know they're competing against the $675. It can't be so much about that or you won't take them. Once we're gone, then there won't be any
bond. Whatever they want.
Yeah. That, yeah.
Well, it looks like that would be one of the main selling points for us.
I think that's what Tommy was trying to say before.
Another question. In my issue with hiring him is we can't get one done without one of his getting involved to fix it or finish it or. But
and everything else that happens, it really makes it even more complicated than it is now when we're trying to negotiate objections and protests for a survey somebody else did, and then they got to go back and move corners. Who's going to pay for that? You are, the applicant, likely. So your fee that was agreed upon at the beginning suddenly is now $300 or $400 or $500 more. Mm-hmm. But we're doing a bunch of the work trying to resolve the management issue of it. So it does make it complicated. It's always done, and there's a reason for that, I think.
Is it fair to say that also law enforcement has used these surveyors in more recent years to...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, law enforcement, fisheries, we're more integrated with fisheries, with fixed fishing devices, and that kind of stuff than we ever have been.
So from a waterman's perspective, if I get caught over here, and I'm pretty sure I'm right, and now I have the ability of you getting a surveyor involved, particularly with the equipment we have now, to say I'm right, now we're going to, how would you have, I mean, would you, you wouldn't get a private, would it be up to the waterman to hire a private surveyor to?
I mean, there's all kinds of scenarios. My view is people who privatize the surveys, that the commission will still have some type of shellfish management, manage the leasing program, because we have to, and we'll have somebody on staff, whether it's the chief engineer in my position, or it's a somebody below me like a surveyor. But we'll have somebody on staff that's a surveyor. But if we only have one, he's not going to do all the applications. You'd have to cut something. And do you want to wait 5 years to get your survey done because we're going to do it and pay $675? Or do you want to hire a private surveyor and get it done in 6 months? That's the unknown questions that I don't know. But
and at some point, you're going to have, whether it's you or your predecessor, you've got to cut off to help. At some point,
right.
If you're backlogged for 5 years and I get a private surveyor, at some point, you're going to have to say, your private surveyor's got to do this. I can't do it for them.
We still have to maintain the public ground lines, the state line, help fishers with fixed fishing devices, help Jim occasionally, his program. So we would still have a lot of surveying type of work here and mapping to do, but if that's our only thing, we only have one person to do it, then we have to cut something. And one big part of our program that we could just turn over to the private sector is all applications and restatements. We just don't do those. And that's the thinking, I think, of how to do that with less people. And some of you who've been here a long time, have been on the earth a long time, remember, and we've gone through periods of trying to privatize what government does because it's more efficient. We went through this under the Allen administration. We did a pilot program. And we had the same result that we're kind of having now. The private sector is not too interested in doing this. It is more complicated. It's liability, land surveying.
Yep.
Falling down on the job on a land survey and hurting yourself is different than falling overboard and drowning for the companies. You know, liability and a boat, you know, all of that. So some land surveyors will get into it if they're the only game in town, but there'll be a lot of land surveyors that won't want to do this, period.
And with aquaculture and cage culture and those sort of things, this is a whole lot more complicated than it was in the time period that you're talking that the pilot was done. My point is just to fellow committee members, this is affecting all of us. It isn't just it's such a small amount of money in the scheme of things. I know it's big to you guys when you're trying to find $100 here and $100 there, but in the scheme of things, it's minuscule in Richmond to what they're.
Right. And my department's pretty much all general fund funded. The rent and all the fees we collect for applicants, all that they all go into the general fund. They're not special funds like ours. You don't pay us $675 or $25, and those funds just go back into the.
Is that the funds that you receive for that? Is that segregated so people that look and evaluate what's going on, they can see the difference, or that's just put in there and never any? There's no.
That's what I'm saying. It's not really.
Doesn't come to us.
No, I'm not suggesting that. I know, like, when I do my accounting, you know, stuff for VEPCO and stuff for the gas company and stuff for insurance and everything is all separate. So the amount of funds that you receive from the monies you get for surveying and the monies that you get for taxes on the ground or rent for the ground, is that all? Is there a way that you can pull that out and so somebody can see?
Well,
I mean, you pull everything else out for the oysters
we know what we collect in rent, but it is not segregated in a way that the General Assembly sees it, obviously, or funds it, obviously.
Well,
just fund our agency a certain amount, and then
I mean, that they see the value that you're getting from the department, that justifies what you need to have, is the point.
They got to hear that from us, though. Yeah, they don't care what he's got to say.
Yeah, but I don't know what it is that you get. So what can I say?
It's a matter of lost services, John. If you look at the problems the General Assembly has at the moment, this one, they've got $1 billion shortfall. Well, if you take the total general budget for the entire Commonwealth and you divide one into the other, you end up with a percentage. The way in which governors, all the way back to Allen before, dealt with this, if it comes out at 4%, they send a blanket statement out to all of the agency heads, and John Paul gets one as well, cut by 4%. Problem solved. No, problem isn't solved. Problem is solved for the guy who's the bean counter who's servicing the governor and the General Assembly. All he's done is pass the problem along to you. And so then the problem becomes, you privatize it, in which case, essentially what you get is a user fee. You either pay it into a private entity instead of paying them directly, or else you end up with a lack of services. The question is never asked in the midst of this, what are the relative values of the services? So in the end, what it comes down to, and I hate to say this, it's a matter of you going and standing this far in front of your representative and saying 5%, 3%, 6%, 2%, which is what you've done for all of these years. What I now do not have in order to support my small business that pays money into the General Assembly coffers is the ability to have appropriate surveying, which will withstand all sorts of legal challenges in terms of where we're going in the future. I don't have a surveyor who disappeared. I have a surveying service that has been in continuity for a long period of time. That's important to my business. I don't have that. I need it. The other thing that I do not have, Rob said, and I've heard it now from four commissioners, and at least I've been, you've been here longer than I have, we don't have enough law enforcement people. And why do we lose law enforcement people? It's the same thing. All state agencies do this, cut 3%, who's retiring in the next 6 months? Okay, that deals with it. This is not a situation where each agency looks at the services they provide. Because all of the services that they provide are justified, and all of them are under-providing in terms of service. The only way you get to this in the end is you have to go stand in front of your General Assembly elected official and shout at them. And what it comes down to in the end is, and you gentlemen who are sitting up there all represent this, there are the small businesses, and they get it. They need to hear, not from someone who's talking about personnel and time, they need to hear it from somebody who's running a small business. You're the heart of the economy of the Commonwealth. They should bloody well listen to you.
Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not allowed to talk to a representative to lobby for that money.
Right, that's correct.
By code.
That's right.
So, that, John, that's where I'm going with.
Well, they should be. Are you allowed to provide us with the information that on what your proceeds are getting from managing the grounds?
And
I mean, so that we have something that would substantiate, support us talking to them.
I think you ought to know how hard you have to work, because I've been amazed all these years. We have roughly a potential of 2,800 commercial licensees, and we have probably 400,000 recreational fishermen, including who comes from out of state. And we all should think that that's very important, especially about the services that Roger's talking about. Permits galore for no charge, things like that. Someone has to do all these permits. There's many, many things done, but what's really, you know, not impressive for us, we are much less than 1% of the entire state budget, and that includes all our sister agencies in the Secretariat. So, you know, that's why it's so difficult to make headway. I don't know who's going to yell at the legislators for that, Roger said, but it certainly comes down to making impacts because of where we are. We're not transportation.
The numbers that Jim put up there.
Yeah.
600,000 bushels a year now. Yeah. That's what? $24 million of the dock. You have $24 million of the dock on the basis of maintaining the stability of that. Amongst other things, is maintaining the integrity of the public and the private leases. So you're going to take a $24 million industry, and over the next year or so, because of retirements, you're liable to lose 75% of the people who tell you where all the bloody boundaries are. So 30 seconds that you can stand in front of a General Assembly person and say, are you going to jeopardize $24 million of the dock with an economic multiplier of anywhere between $400 million a year because you won't put in $200,000 a year to maintain the stability of the lease of the boundary system? That is absolutely stupid.
So if what you're saying, the amount... The fact that they're taking in a certain amount of money to take care of the rents and stuff like that, that's not the issue.
No, it's
the total amount of money that's the issue.
No, the way in which these things work, and I've dealt with it 20 miles up the road for a long time, is their attitude is that the money that comes in terms of all of the things that you pay the agency for, and Ben has said several times, goes into the general fund that runs the entity. When the state looks at your budget as a state agency, they don't look at this piece that we give you and that piece that comes in. It's a single bowl of money. And what they do is they do that calculation at the beginning, cut 3%, and they tell you just to take 3% out of it. When you're left with managing that, you end up in the situation, and BMRC is particularly vulnerable because it's all people.
It's hard for me to think like that as a businessman. Yeah. I'm thinking profit and loss, and I just cannot. I have a hard time with the concept that P&L has no value whatsoever. Not that you guys don't care about it.
Those guys are not businessmen. The number that I gave you.
Maybe that's why we're getting a new president, a businessman. Maybe that's why that's happening. Because this is just as. I don't get it.
It makes no sense. That is what you need to do. I've made part of my career out of lobbying politicians. In all truth, they're not interested in oysters. They're interested in money. And if you go and put those two numbers in front of them, $200,000 a year, $24 million at the dock, is it worth investing $200,000 a year to maintain the integrity of that? It's a simple question, yes or no.
Also, I think the industry, you know, in various parts has been effective in going to Richmond or lobbying for oyster replenishment funds or positions at VMRC or shellfish sanitation, things that protect this industry. So the opportunity does exist out there. You know, if you would like information, I think, from VMRC to make some phone calls, I think maybe that would be helpful to the entire committee.
Can this committee request just a three-paragraph blurb of what we're talking about here? Are you allowed to?
Sure.
Yeah, we probably could.
With basically the amount of money that
before Jane retires, we have to get her quickly.
Next week.
No,
is
but
week at the General Assembly.
Yeah, no.
Our rocket science for my department. We rent ground.
No,
128,000 acres
times $1.50. You know, what I'm looking for is just something that John has in his hand that he can use to substantiate very easily.
Well, even if we had some kind of generic thing that we could give to other people to send under their name to their legislatures, just to bombard them.
I think
the
Roger's point is
well
taken. Yeah, a conversation with somebody you know as a legislator would do far more than send a letter like that.
Well,
a phone call to. If you know your Newber News guy,
David Yancey,
down
to in your case.
Yeah, I know David.
Yeah.
And he's very sympathetic to it. Well, Ken has shown to be very sympathetic to our industry, so. Mm-hmm.
So maybe you have a couple bullet points that could be put together. Okay.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yep. Okay. Point well taken.
Blast it out by email to us, and
so
we'll have something definitive that we can use to
in the next day or so.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are two other bills, if I'm not mistaken, and they are the same. Essentially, it has to do with oyster dredging through private ground. So this is put in by. And specifically the Lynn Haven and its tributaries. It has to do with private residential piers that go out and cannot get to navigable waters. So they would have the ability to dredge, you know, hire a private dredging company and dredge from the end of their pier to navigable waters. And if, in fact, from the end of the pier to the navigable water you have private ground, then that would be somehow compensated. It's unclear how it would be compensated, but that bill exists both in the Senate and the House at this point. And those are the only other two, I think, right?
The committee.
The advisory committees?
Well, you know, when they do dredge like that, you have slumping from adjacent areas. That, you know, you cut a nice channel through there, you have all this stuff slumps into it. That's the way it always works.
So there are a lot of problems with that bill, too.
Yeah.
How wide, how deep, how long the channel's going to be. It's not defined at all.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have an area that's got a mean low water of 2 feet and you want to bring in a 40-foot yacht, and they're just going to blow it out. Really, honestly, that could happen under this bill. I mean, anything could happen. So it needs some work. And we'll be working on that bill. Yeah, Kim?
You got one more. The registration of commercial fishermen requires exemption penalty that allows licenses to be handed down.
That's right. So, do you all know about that one, Jim? No?
I can tell you about that one. So, you know, what you may know, and it came up in this committee, was a lot of unhappiness about 2.5 years ago, because there had been, since 1995, the ability for someone to send in an application and say, I've worked the water my whole life. I need to have an exemption. And you look and you say, well, they never had a license, but they worked the water their whole life, which they could have been a helper doing that their whole life. So needless to say, there were a lot of new licensees that did not go through the two-year delay. They just got in the fishery. This compounded the fishery that you are most interested in on the committee, which is the oyster fishery, because it helps scale up those who could jump into the oyster fishery. So finally, in July of 2015, the commission agreed that there should not be any more exceptions on that basis. And the only exceptions that are left in the regulation are if you had a medical problem, let's say in 2016, and you didn't apply for the commercial card in time, then if you had the, you know, the testimony of a physician that you had a medical problem, you could get that card. The other thing which has always been there is the immediate family member, one in, one out. What this does is it resubstantiates what already exists, which is the one in and one out of someone who's retiring. That's the way the language is. So if someone's retiring, leaving the fishery, an immediate family member can take over that person's place. The second part is that if there is someone who is working in the industry but is not a licensee, but is working on the boat, working as a helper, working as a mate, whatever you want to call it, that when the licensee retires, the commercial license can go to that individual as well. Now, in thinking about this, one of the biggest complaints we've had over the years is generated an apprenticeship. I mean, I can remember from as far back as into the late 80s that our committee, Finfish Management Advisory Committee, and before that was just FMAC, would say there's no way for anyone to get in this fishery and apprentice and do all that. If you look at this one way, that's apprenticeship. So if you have someone, a licensee of someone who's been working for him, I don't know what the duration should be, but has been learning the trade, has been working on the water, everything else, then that's kind of like an apprenticeship system. I think in the past, the interest on apprenticeship was more on younger individuals, to get younger individuals in the fishery. How much of that would come from this bill? You know, it's hard to say. The main thing is that there not be a tangling up of different family members who want to have rights to that card, because the way it's written, it's one in and one out. The same thing with the, I'll call it the apprentice person, one in, one out. You can't believe, well, yes, you can believe anything, but you can't believe the situations that we get involved in over transferring commercial licenses and other gear licenses. We're not lawyers. Thank God we have a good attorney general's office person that helps us. I mean, these get really tricky, so there's always that little bit of doubt as to how this bill would end up. But the way it is right now, it's pretty much one in, one out. And the other good part of it, it's not going back to the system where, you know, I thought I was pretty clever 7 or 8 years ago when I had people who were harvesters go and make an affidavit that Joe Smith has worked for me in all these fisheries. And then I'd review the data, and the fisheries that Joe Smith was supposed to work in, the guy who vouched for him hadn't even worked in those fisheries. So I said, well, I failed at trying to make things a little more honest. So overall, I think we're looking at this as an agency, at least, as not a problematic situation. You still want to watch over it, because we spent too many years cleaning up what had happened from about 1995 until 2015. And, you know, you talk about time to talk to these people and try and get the actual facts from them, and what did you really do, and what fisheries, and then the affidavit that I came up with, none of it helped. So, so the two-year delay should be the cornerstone still of getting into the fisheries. And part of the rationale that was written for this, I know, was that, you know, you do have to be careful. You don't want to bring in effort that all of a sudden is a burst of effort into a fishery that hasn't had that type of effort. So
that's
what I know about that.
All right, thank you.
One thing I'd like to ask, and excuse me for being so delayed and my brain working properly, but in getting back to this money that would go to the department for surveying and everything,
right,
if we were successful in talking to the legislatures to get more money to go to VMRC, would they be able to allocate it specifically to the department that we're talking about right here, or would it be just go to VMRC total and it would get whacked up among everybody?
I don't see why it wouldn't just go to the...
It's a line item in there now. So, yeah.
So they could go directly. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Lastly, there is one more bill, and that has to do with advisory committees, much like the one you're sitting on. So there's one bill to, I guess, define or better define or redefine some of the committees. So that's out there as well. Not just Shellfish Advisory Committee, but deals with the term limits, you know, how long you can be on a committee, how many members are on the committee, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Any questions? I think that covers all of them currently that have to do maybe with shellfish related. So it's active, best I can say.
Well, I would hope I could speak just for a minute. On the committee. So the interesting thing here is we've never had these committees codified before. So in 1989, Commissioner Pruitt developed all the committees. And we sat over there, and he came up, we had the Waterman's presidents here, and he said, I'm going to have all these committees, which we have today. but there's seven altogether that are talked about. They include the saltwater tournament, any committee that we have nine members, which I think Jim made the comment to me earlier today, if that were the case, we would probably not have quorums in a lot of committees. I mean, some committees like FinFish, we have 16 to 18 individuals, CRAB, we probably have about 15 in the CRAB Management Advisory Committee. The other thing is it would remove standing committees now, and then you'd go through a replacement process. And the term limits is right. It'd be based on how the commission operates. On someone has 2 years, someone has 4 years. As you probably know, two things about committees. One, there's a reason there's someone on committees for 10 or 20 years, because it's hard to get people on committees. And secondly, it's hard to get the expertise that already exists. So this particular bill really is not improving the situation by trying to identify through code what the committees are. The committees are already there, and they do operate very well overall. I mean, there are some hiccups, but they operate very well. So watch out for this bill. Delegate Bloxham's the patron, and this does sort of get into a situation where you just kind of wonder why. You know, what's promoted all this? And I don't know.
But don't have a clue.
Do not. I mean, there are constituents out there, we know that, and just like we're talking about, perhaps some of you talking to your legislators, well, there are constituents who aren't happy with certain things, and they're trying to figure out a way to get a better advantage. And that's all I can tell you.
Any other questions? Jim, do you have anything else? So congratulations on retirement. I guess this would be your last SBAC, unless you plan on having another one in 3 weeks. All right, so I guess Andrew will be making the next one. And when do you expect that would be?
Usually it's, you know, getting ready for the season. So
August?
Try to go to the July commission meeting with requests for public hearings in August, so probably right. June.
Yeah. Anybody have anything else?
Motion for adjournment.
All right, sounds good. So moved. Adjourned.
Oh yeah. One thing, no.